for Canadians with disabilities, whether it's through positive portrayal, reflection, and accessible media. AMI believes everyone should be included, and that includes you. AMI is inclusion. Experience AMI at amiplus.ca.
Have you ever been to Extended Family Kingston?
Stop by and visit our programs and talk to our staff to find out how our staff will support you.
So many things we like best are golf,
doing crafts,
hanging with friends,
and gardening.
I like doing everything at EAF. We just love Extended Family.
Visit us at www.efkingston.com.
Come on down to EFK, located at 660 Baggett Street, for a great time. Be a part of our extended family.
Come to Extended Family. Come and have some fun.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
So hello and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I am your host of this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you missed the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on across campus. So today, I would like to introduce you to Alicia Kuzner, who's doing a Master's of Education in the World Indigenous Studies Education Program under the supervision of Dr. Jennifer Davis. Welcome to Grad Chat, Alicia.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
Oh, thank you for joining us. So I'm very excited to talk about your project and learn more because it sounds fascinating. So the title of your thesis is Decolonizing Educational Environments, an analysis of experiences shared by educators in the National Capital Region. So you've touched on this a little bit, kind of some of the things that inspired you, but can you tell us more about your project specifically and what that involved?
Yeah, so whenever people hear the word decolonizing, I think people think of it as an end goal. They're like, okay, what does it look like? Mm-hmm. And what I always start off by saying is that it's a process. It's a never-ending process. So it's an action word rather than an end destination goal.
It's not something you can just check off once you've accomplished it. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I was looking at is specifically in the Ottawa and Gatineau region, what does it look like, or how is it at least appearing during this process? Mm-hmm. And are there patterns and trends based on, because I mean, in Ottawa, we have many different school boards. We have the Catholic school board, which is public funded. We have the English school board, public funded. We have a French school board, which is public funded, of both elementary, I believe, and high school. And for like at least two different boards, mm-hmm. I believe. I'll have to maybe double check that. Might be one board for the both. And then we have all the private schools. So, and there are many in Ottawa. And I think for anyone who at least maybe has kids that are in school or has paid attention to the number of private schools that have popped up since COVID, it's like a mega boom. So I was curious. I was like, is there similarities, like as if a teacher is identifying as someone who's trying to decolonize their educational environment, space, programming, is there a pattern or a trend among teachers? Because Ottawa is fairly large in terms of the region. And I was also including Gatineau, but sadly, I didn't get any participants who volunteered from Gatineau.
Okay.
So I only had my Ottawa teachers. But I talked about that as well. I would love if someone redid the study and made it bigger and was able to get Gatineau teachers and do a full comparison. But yeah, and so I looked at the patterns and trends just through thematic coding and yeah, looked at how it was appearing in Ottawa.
And what did you find? What does decolonizing mean in respect to education in the Ottawa region right now? What is it? And like you said, people are trying to find it. What does it look like? So in the Ottawa area, what does it look like for teachers who are trying to decolonize their classrooms?
Yeah, Ottawa is so fascinating in terms of its history because, yes, it's the capital, but the history of Ottawa starts way before it became the capital. Mm-hmm. And so, but before it became the capital, it was very American. And the original settlers of Ottawa were from Massachusetts. And they were part of the rebels that fought against the British. And right before the War of 1812, so this was like 1798, Philemon Wright, the first settler who led the 40 families up into Ottawa, came up into what is this region now, mm-hmm. Ottawa, met with the indigenous leaders and the indigenous chiefs of the area who were the Algonquin peoples. And because Ottawa was outside of the proclamation zone, I feel like this is a total side rant.
Okay, go for it.
But whenever we say we are on unceded land, mm-hmm. a lot of people say it, but they don't know what it means.
Yes.
And then when you say, oh, okay, well, it's just that like it wasn't claimed. There was no treaty. There was no agreement. It was just taken. People are like, well, yeah, that's called like the British just coming in and taking stuff. That's just how mm-hmm. it was. And it's like, no, actually, it wasn't like that at all. And I think when people don't fully understand the history of their own local area fully, they tend to just assume, right? I always say, like, in order to show true respect to the people of our past, you can't glorify them and dehumanize them in the sense that it's like they could do no wrong. You still have to look critically at every aspect of how things came to be, because everything is a cause and consequence. So to understand what's mm-hmm. happening now, you have to know what happened in the past.
So taking this kind of long view of history and this longer, very transnational view of history as well, and it sounds like that it helps inform your understanding of why, you know, decolonization might look specific in Ottawa compared to other places or other regions. Yeah. So are teachers including this kind of these kinds of histories in their classrooms, and why are they choosing to decolonize their classrooms?
Yeah, so when you start to understand that Ottawa's original settler history is mm-hmm. very much American, and then military, and then it became the capital, and that's really when Ottawa was trying to push the British image, right? Like mm-hmm. Britain, England, British loyalists, you know, like represent the crown. And it was a pretty dramatic shift. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the Ottawa like literature for education of what they're being provided in the classroom, the literary canons, the books that they're mm-hmm. reading, usually it's British authors. It's very rare, even to this day, to see teachers include material that is not written by an American or by a British author, or has, especially going back to the English classes, but mm-hmm. a lot of short stories, even when you think back to your own high school, like Monkey's Paw, you know, like the Dangerous Game, the Lottery, Shakespeare, like everything is going back, right, to Britain. And then the modern stuff is very American, heavy, mm-hmm. heavy, heavy American. And there is a real disconnect of the Algonquin people that are here currently, very much still established. Mm-hmm. And we have so many resources available too, like which was interesting in my findings, is that although I find there is a huge disconnect still currently, because the teachers that are actively trying to decolonize their environment and bring in these new resources, mm-hmm. they say, they're like, we have access to the Ottawa Native Friendship Center, which has a lot of available online resources for different things. There's a lot of Indigenous writers. Mm-hmm. And Ottawa being the capital, we have a huge Inuk population. People from who live in the Arctic have to fly down to Ottawa to get medical treatment. And just from over the years, people sometimes just stay, right? And so mm-hmm. although like it's funny because Edmonton, I believe, still has the largest Inuk population or population of Inuit people, but Ottawa has the most speakers. We have so many Inuktitut speakers in Ottawa.
Mm.
And so
outside of the north, right? Like,
terms of our, in terms of southern cities. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of resources to incorporate like Inuit contemporary literature and perspectives available. And I find that when we're looking at boards, they really are trying to monitor everything that enters the classroom, which they didn't used to. It's a very interesting shift with public education. Before, teachers had full autonomy over their classrooms and could really bring in whatever they wanted and share whatever they wanted because they were trusted experts, considering that, you know, we go to school for like 7 years. We know what we're doing. But now I'm noticing that a lot of teachers are being denied things. So, and being nervous.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So some teachers were trying to bring in just different, like for instance, Kite Runner was approved, but then
that's a book.
Yeah, so for anyone who's read Kite Runner, it's, I'm trying to remember, I think it actually came out maybe in 2009, and it's a pretty powerful book, and it has some pretty heavy topics, and you would read it in a grade 12 class, so that you could have the maturity level to analyze it, look for themes, cause, consequence, historical dimensions, that sort of thing. But then when the same teacher tried to bring in a book that was of equal level of reading ability and themes, but of the local Indigenous context, they didn't deny it, and this is another theme that we notice, is that the board just says pending approval. They don't want to say no, because then they have to give a reason maybe for saying no. And this isn't just the public English board, this is also the Catholic board. And I think what's happening is that administration is becoming a little nervous about how are they going to deal with parents that don't understand material that's happening in the classroom.
Okay.
But rather than figuring out how they're going to explain it to the parents, they just say it's easier just to say no and not deal with it because we have too much on our plate, which involves other factors.
Yeah, that sounds like one type of barrier to decolonizing the classroom is access to local resources and relevant resources, as you said, to kind of escaping this British and American literary canon, trying to find other things to supplement the classroom. And are there other barriers that teachers have faced? And also, how do they get around those to be successful in approaching decolonizing in their classroom?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find that like when I was trying to figure out and look at patterns of what it looks like with teachers when they're trying to decolonize, and they're in that process of actively trying to decolonize, one of the participants said it best. She said it's the action of decentering and recentering your mentality and trying to also recognize those habitual habits and patterns that we are raised with. As a teacher, often we base our teaching practices on what we witnessed when we were kids growing up and what worked in the classroom for us and this and that. It makes sense, right? But trying to now actively decenter yourself and, just out of curiosity, explore other environments. So if you are someone who always excelled in a classroom that had four walls and you're sitting at a desk and it was really rigid, really routine, very well structured, some kids do very well with that. But you can also make your expectations very clear with your what is going to be graded and what is the process, very clear. Move it outside or do something where it's not with the same or typical book that you were using, and just exploring the ways that you can take, let's say, all your Shakespeare lesson plans where you're looking at sonnets and you're looking at themes, you're looking at poetic devices, and now do a different, either one, you don't have to do plays. This is another thing, like for anyone who doesn't know, teaching, you are basing your lessons on the expectations of the ministry. So when you are given a very like simple ministry expectation of sonnets, you could say, okay, I'm going to do Shakespeare and I'm going to look at sonnets. But you don't have to. If you don't think that Shakespeare is relevant to your population, put that lesson aside and grab something new. So teachers are also swapping. They might get a class where it's like, yeah, these kids these are Shakespeare kids. You know, like, they're really into this this idea of Shakespeare. And maybe, and I've even had, like, there was one teacher that gave option. And would be like, are you guys interested in Romeo and Juliet? You know, and if it's a class full of women who are like, no, it's a little weird that, like, a full-grown adult man is, like, you know, with a child. You know, like, when you really look at some Shakespeare stuff, it's pretty heavy as well, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not appropriate for that class. And then you look at other plays or other poems. For me, I love Pauline Johnson. Like, I look at her poetry all the time for analysis because Pauline Johnson has so much poetry. And she's a Mohawk poet that was alive, I believe, from 1860 to the, I think she passed away early 1900s.
I think that sounds about right. Yes, around.
Yeah. The main, most of her poems were written around that, like, 1860 time when she was in the Muskoka area. And so even when you're reading her poems and you're like, oh my goodness, she's describing this lake that I've been to. And it actually has the same vibes, even though that poem was written 150, 200 years ago. It's way more relatable because she's writing about Lake Ontario. She's writing about areas that a lot of these students have been to. So it was just more relevant. I think you can look at this person is experiencing the same things 200 years ago that we are experiencing now.
I wonder too, hearing access to resources, I think it sounds like in even not that long ago, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, resources were a lot more physical in nature and paper-based. So maybe teachers felt stuck teaching the same materials they had because, you know, they had a class set of Romeo and Juliet for grade 9 English. So that's what they were going to teach with. But now with the internet and the availability of open access publishing and so many works being available, I think it sounds like it opens a lot more opportunities, really cost-effective opportunities for teachers to pull in, you know, authors, local authors, and authors from, I guess, around the world as well, but without the cost of, you know, having to purchase a whole set of physical books for their classroom every year. Was that something that came up in your research, the availability of online versus physical resources or anything like that?
So, yeah, you would think that with everything being digital now, that it should be easier to get your hands on these resources. But what I was noticing with all of the transcripts and analysis is that it's almost the opposite.
Okay.
It's a mix of different barriers. So we have one barrier where there is a licensing issue with reproduction of text. So teachers can only photocopy up to a certain amount legally. So how much can you work around this? And depending on if you're with the board or with a private school, it depends on what you're allowed to reproduce. And then, so that's one issue. Another issue is that to, I think, combat that, the fact that there's a plethora of stuff that you can use, the boards then tried to streamline it by department. So it's like the departments of the boards of, like, let's say English get together and they decide on, like, what is the material that will be used in the school board, and every year they should update and talk and submit new ideas. And then it comes down to, is it being applied? So with all the budget cuts and with our lack of staff, because we are not only across Ontario, there's not only less funds coming in than there were before, but there's also more students to accommodate. And they have gotten rid of teaching positions because back in 2014, there was a surplus of teachers. And they thought that switching the Bachelor's of Education program to 2 years would deter people from becoming teachers and therefore slow down the surplus of teachers that existed 10 years ago. And then Doug Ford also removed teacher positions and made the classroom sizes larger and incorporated the online perspective. Now students have to do an online course in public school, I think, every year. But the problems is just that when you have a larger student body to one teacher ratio.
The ratio.
Yeah, you don't teach the way you used to. And so the materials that were available or approved aren't going to work, you know?
Okay.
And even in the sense that, like, you're trying to do, let's say, a lab. I talked to some science teachers. There are so many ways to decolonize math and science. I think it arguably might even be easier than, like, English and other those types of courses. But they are so limited with their availability to these like actual materials and the ability to leave the school grounds. I think for most teachers, they're just like, all the budget we need is just a field trip permission form for us to go to Carleton University or Queen's University to visit a lab or something, or like something, you know, but trying to get permission to take your class outside of school is what appears to be almost impossible.
across
multiple schools. And it's sad.
Yeah. So it sounds like general financial barriers and lack of personnel, as well as resource access. Yeah.
And also it's almost like the bureaucratic process of education has tenfolded. So like even when I was a kid in school, my mom was allowed to volunteer in the school. I know many parents that used to volunteer in schools to help assist the classroom when there was tougher classes, you know, even back in the day. You can't do that anymore. You can't volunteer in a school. You have to become a volunteer with the board. So I am a volunteer with the board. So to be a volunteer with the board now, let's say you can't just like ask the principal to go in. You have to get the RCMP special check for education, which is across Canada. I love it. It's great. You know, awesome. But then you get added to a pool of volunteers for the entire board. And then you're being emailed to go to all these other schools. And then you need the principal to request a volunteer. And then you have to, it's almost like a job application. Wow. So it is so much work that even when you want to just bring in a guest speaker, it has to be an approved. They have to go through this process. So it is really hard now to get the good resources like we did, which was like the people, right? Like humans. Humans.
So I remember lots of parents and grandparents and community members coming into the class to share what they did, or even just doing nature walks as kids at local, you know, just outside of the school grounds. But, you know, a few parents might show up just to make sure, especially in the junior grades, that we didn't lose any students along the way, that kind of thing. But it sounds like that's a lot more, much, much more challenging and much more bureaucratic to do even those kind of simple excursions where there's no fees, there's no bus involved, but you're still leaving the school grounds. So therefore, it takes a lot of work. Or
bringing someone into the safety of the school, being supervised, like obviously never left alone with the students. I think it's quite interesting that you can't have volunteers anymore. And and then even for me to go through the process, because I was like, I'm going to do this process because I want to know how hard it is to get to volunteer to school.
And you're a certified teacher, so, and you're an OCT, like you're an OCT yourself, so know that that's challenging as a teacher to volunteer. It's well, that's very interesting. And what are some of the successful decolonizing practices that you found in your research?
So what I'm finding is that teachers are really good at adapting. I don't know if it's COVID or what, but they are excellent at adapting. And so when they are actively going back to the decentering and recentering their mindsets of what is the main goal of education. And I personally love the education pedagogy of Ontario. And by pedagogy, that just means basically it's the Bible or the sacred rule of teachers,
the teaching main, philosophy
or the message, our core message and core belief values is that all students can succeed. And how do we do that? So it's almost like don't forget the assignment, right? Don't forget the main goal. Try to push everything aside. How can we meet that goal? And that's what decolonizing is. So it's like okay, we have always been in this time structure of, let's say, 75 minutes per class with these desks. I don't have a budget, but I can try to work with this. Let's, you know, create, have our desks in, let's say, one part of the classroom. The other section of the classroom is going to be more of a story fluid area where students can work in other areas so they don't have to work at their desks. To even offer areas where students can kind of have a little bit of a, I don't know, mental, like, just uncheck your brain for a second when you're in high school is really handy.
A little decompressing space, things like that,
And they're noticing, the teachers are noticing at least, that are doing this and trying all these different methods of different spaces and different styles of teaching, constantly looking at even the indigenous pedagogy of what is learning and to focus more on the process than the product, and developing that whole understanding of the learning process, which is very difficult. A lot of people don't want to do it because it's like, you know, it's hard to learn something new, and to work through it, all the failures, and to how to cope with failure, all those life lessons that are intertwined are so important. And then to give praise to that so that it's not just a mark at the end of the day, but feedback, feedback, feedback. So praising students on their accomplishments, identifying areas of behavior that needs to be changed because it's going to lead them down a path where they're not going to succeed, you know, and trying to constantly redirect them, but not being limited by the ways that it used to be done. And you, and even when people question you, it's okay to be questioned. You just have to explain what you're doing. When a parent says, why are you removing all the desks in your classroom? This seems like a terrible idea. Explain it to them, make them understand the process. Try it out. And if it's not working for the kids, bring it back to the way it was before, you know, like, like, okay, I didn't work, you know, like try to sample some things. And
no, it sounds, very an open approach and a holistic approach too. Yeah. And it sounds like you said, decentering. So teachers thinking of themselves as maybe guides and supporters, but maybe not the expert on everything in the room. I think that's it's what I'm sounding like is quite a shift in the mindset of some of the teachers you may have interacted with.
And trying to bring it back to as local as possible. So even understanding, it can be, like we looked, even within my thesis when I was having a discussion with the participants, we looked at the differences of indigenizing versus decolonizing. So yes, some teachers were bringing in local indigenous material and experts to talk about, like for instance, there was a geography teacher who brought in a land-based indigenous elder who was very knowledgeable. He was also a PhD in geology. And so it was an excellent connection because they were able to talk about the connections between the local geography, why we have certain buildings built this way, so the connections to architecture and design, as well as the Algonquin perspective. But teachers were also looking at just the decolonizing mentality as well, where there isn't necessarily an indigenous element, but looking at why do we have so many British flags everywhere if there was never really any, other than the wave of loyalists, that some loyalists did come up to Ottawa. A lot of them were in the Kingston area, you know, they didn't come too far up, but like, you know, why not all the other cultures that are represented here? Is it only because we were given the name Capital City, which obviously is a part of Ottawa's identity, absolutely, but it's not the only element, and arguably it's not even the number one element, because there is a much larger, more significant history that is not British that should be understood.
So it sounds like, yeah, just really trying to widen our understanding of Ottawa's place in history, but not just Canada's history, in history, indigenous history, well, Algonquin history specifically, long before European settlement, and specifically British settlement in this case. But what's the most important thing you want our listeners to take away from your master's project today?
I would say to everyone that if you are ever feeling lost in your educational journey, look at maybe the expectations that are placed upon you. I find that during my decolonizing process, and I'm still going through it, obviously, I noticed that by decolonizing, my anxiety also lowered. Because there's a lot of colonial expectations on us. And often when you start to analyze that, just start to analyze yourself and why do you have these expectations? It is also part of the process of decolonizing your mindset. And when I was graduating from Queen's after my Bachelor of Education, I was so anxious with what I thought I needed to do and where the direction I needed to go. And there was like no compromise in my brain. And I just find that the more you try to work towards decolonizing your mentality, the more you start to feel more comfortable in yourself, a place. And I just hope that everyone doesn't experience any anxiety as they are finishing up or starting off their school years, because it's all going to work out as long as you just keep looking at yourself, right? Just keep checking yourself, checking your anxiety, checking your direction. What is your goal? Why do you have that goal? If you feel like the goal maybe isn't that good, change direction. That is okay. Mm-hmm. that's the point. and just, yeah, keep exploring and keep having fun because it'll work out.
Thank you, Svetli, Alicia. And it has been great chatting with you today. Thanks for doing the show and good luck with the rest of your research. And I'm excited to see where these lessons that you've taken from your work translate into your practice, as well as, you know, helping other teachers who are exploring decolonizing what they can take into their practice moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It was really fun.
I'm glad. And so that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Come on out October 16th, 17th, and 18th for two mega sales under one roof. The Quality Inn Hotel at 33 Benson Street is hosting its Zara-branded outerwear sale and mega sports sale featuring jackets, parkas, jerseys, hoodies, toques, and more just in time for those cooler temperatures. Students get a 10% discount on everything. Head out to the Quality Inn 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Thursday and Friday, and then on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. for great deals on outerwear and sports apparel.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Today on Wings, from prisoner to paralegal. Anybody getting arrested will experience considerable psychological stress, and even more so if she's the mother of a young child. In Kenya, as elsewhere, many women who face criminal charges have no education or tools to defend themselves. At the Shimo La Tewa Maximum Security Prison, that has changed.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Kituo cha Sharia, Legal Advice Center, is a Kenyan NGO established in 1973 to enhance equity and access to justice for poor and marginalized people. For over 50 years, they've offered direct legal assistance, paralegal training, mentoring, advocacy, and even lobbying. As of 2023, Kituo expanded its services at the Shimo La Tewa Maximum Security Prison to include a special facility where women prisoners get paralegal advice and training. Because mothers are allowed to have their young children in prison with them, the program also looks after the kids. Wings reporter Diana Wanyonyi recorded two women closely associated with creating this project, one from Kituo and one from the Kenya Prison Service.
My name is Annette Mbogo. I am the executive director of Kituo cha Sheria. That's a non-governmental organization that works around access to justice. We have been implementing a prison paralegal program across Kenya that focuses on access to justice for inmates. So we train the inmates with legal knowledge, also for them to understand the procedures of court so that they can use it for their own cases, but also they share it with other inmates. And we also train a few officers as well so that they can support the inmates. So this program has run from 2007. It actually started from Shimo La Tewa Men's Prison. Mm-hmm. Around 2011, we felt that we needed to extend this to the women's side because the women inmates would send their documents to the men's side for assistance. So we thought, why not start one also in the women's prison? So around 2011, we set up the center. And the women, a lot of them have been trained through the years, and many leave after they have been trained because they now know how to handle their cases and they're able to defend themselves adequately. But in the more recent past, between 2019 to last year, we trained 90 women inmates as paralegals together with prison officers. And as at now, those numbers have gone down from 90 to 7. The 83 have all been discharged and they've gone home. And this is just within the span of around 2-3 years, meaning that they were able to use those capacities to also find their way out. So what we did is with the support from the Austrian embassy, the Austrian embassy gave us some funds to create a space, a safe space, where the women paralegals in Shimo La Tewa will be able to attend to other inmates. And at the same time, they have what they require in terms of equipment to be able to carry out those tasks. And today we officially opened that office, which has refurbished space within the prison. And we did that also with the support of the Deputy Commissioner General of Prison, meaning that the correctional department is very excited about improving of this infrastructure for the prison so that we are able to jointly promote access to justice. And in doing so, we are reducing the population in prison. And now we all know that the population is too high. It's in fact double what the facilities can maintain. So when people are released, it also helps the Kenya Prison Service. It helps people access justice. And I think the society is made more equitable in the long run. So so when we talk about poor and marginalized communities, we are referring to those who do not have resources to hire a lawyer to represent them. And also by virtue of their income or lack of it, they are not able to. Maybe they are illiterate, and so they're not able to understand the court procedures. So you'd find that majority of the women, especially in the women's side of prison, are usually illiterate. So in as much as the court proceedings would be in Swahili, you know, there's still documentation you have to understand. So they will not be able to understand that for themselves. And at the same time, because they're in prison pending trial, means also they cannot afford to pay cash bail or to secure a bond for them to be released and for their cases to be done when they're outside. So this group is now the group we are seeing are poor and marginalized, meaning they have a right to representation, knowledge that they can adequately defend themselves in court, but now they can't do that. And so they need assistance. And that assistance, we're not saying as Kituo that we are helping, you know, criminals to get out of prison. What we are saying is we have people who, because of their lack of income, they end up in prison because they cannot present their defense well enough. And everyone has a right under our constitution to legal representation. They have a right to a fair trial, and they also have a right to the trial being completed within a reasonable time. So if you are uneducated, you don't have a lawyer to represent you, then these rights are being violated, because you'd find many of them will just say yes to the charges that are read to them. They'll not know what question to ask the witnesses who come. They will not even know who they should identify as a witness. They will not know how they can defend or present their case. If they're on appeal, they don't know how to draft the appeal documents. And so those are the ones that we are assisting. So that at the end of the day, the court will make a decision based on a case that has been properly presented. to court. And if fine, they are found guilty, that is fine, because it would have been a fair process. But if they end up not being found guilty because of the intervention, then also again you find that there would be a justice outcome.
That was Annette Mbogo, Executive Director of Kituo Cha Sharia Legal Advice Center. Kituo works closely with the Kenya Prison Service, which is also supportive of the paralegal training program. Florence Omundi is Kenya's Senior Deputy Commissioner of Prisons and the Liaison Officer for the African Correctional Services Association.
Thank you. My name is Florence Omundi Momanyi. I'm the Deputy Commissioner General of the Kenya Prison Service. Today marks a major milestone in the history of the Kenya Prison Service, especially for the women, in that today we were privileged to have the Austrian Ambassador commission a project, which is a building for use by the female inmates who are serving their sentences in Chimbula Tawim Prison under the paralegal program. The project was coordinated by the Kituo cha Sheria and sponsored by the Austrian Embassy. This project is very important because it really touches on the core, that is the child, in the sense that when you give a mother access to justice, then you know you are like making justice for the child come closer. And I'm talking about the child who is 0 to 4 years of age accompanying the mother to prison. And therefore, this facility that was commissioned today will help the women inmates who in most cases are not able to articulate their issues, learn to understand the court process, get skills and knowledge, get empowerment so that they can be able to stand in court and defend themselves because of the support that they'll get from the paralegals who are either inmates or staff. And this project also has a facility within it for children accompanying their mothers in prison, such that when their mothers are getting access to justice by being trained as paralegals or by a paralegal officer or inmate, their child can also be playing at the back of the room. We have several prisons also which have paralegalism, but you see for the women, they are limited. And you know, Chimbula Tewa Women Prison serves women who are serving maximum sentences, unlike the other prisons. That is, we have Lang'ata, which is a maximum facility. Chimbula Tewa is also now being classified as a maximum facility because of the high-risk offenders, the terrorists and all that. So I would say this is unique, much as we have these facilities within the country. But this is unique because it's in a female institution, and it serves women who are serving longer sentences and for more serious offenses. We have 106 women and 6 children as of today. But the number fluctuates. Mainly it goes up. Generally, women are marginalized. Women are poor. And some of the challenges they are facing, for example, is that they cannot access legal aid. You know, they cannot afford a lawyer. Some of them cannot afford even legal fees. Yeah? These women, some of them can also not even afford to get a relative from home to come and assist them. Women in Chimbula Tewa come also from the coast region, Kilifi, Kwale, up to Hola. And you can imagine that this coastal region, the women are marginalized. Not many women are economically empowered. That means that this project brings justice closer to them and addresses marginalization and the vulnerability that faces special women from around this area. But you know, a mother is a mother. Whether you've committed a crime or not, and a child is a human being, not a number. So children accompanying their mothers to prison are people. At the very formative age, at that early developmental stage of their lives, they find themselves serving a sentence when they are victims actually because of their mothers. And so what happens is that as a mother serves the sentence, she's given an opportunity to get a rehabilitation program. As this happens, the prisons have made arrangements to have the child taken care of by another caregiver. This caregiver is normally a prisoner who is trained in caregiving, but with also an officer who is trained in early childhood development and education, or one who has been given skills in taking care of children. So this child does not necessarily have to be with the mother during the day. The child is taken care of by another caregiver who is not the primary caregiver, because the mother would be the primary caregiver, so that the mother has a chance of attending a rehabilitation program, has a chance of doing other works, including even like now, when they go to court, they'll go with their children to court, you see. But when they go for paralegal training, they will not go with their children. Their children will be taken care of by somebody. This is where what we are calling skills and knowledge, because paralegalism is also a skill that this woman can use even after the expiry of her sentence. So the child does not have to be locked up during the day. That's what we are saying. And she also doesn't have to also be locked up with all the other inmates during the night. We have mother-child units. But during the day, you're introducing a concept of detaching from the mother so that you prepare the child for school going. Yeah? That school going age. You also prepare the child that the mother will not be sitting with them every day. The mother has to go out to work, and the child goes to school. So you see, you are introducing this during the formative years. Yeah. That's why you'll see that even that daycare is not right inside the prison walls. It's slightly outside, those are, so that the child has a concept of walking out, going to school, and detaching from the mother slowly, so that you help them to grow up strong mentally, and so that you also help up them to grow up able to even defend themselves while with other children, instead of staying with grown-ups throughout the day.
When she was asked how this project helped women serving life sentences, the Deputy Commissioner of Prisons gave this passionate response.
It is actually more important for the life sentence women than even for those others. Why? Those others know they will go out, whether they defend themselves or not. But the one on life sentence has no hope. The hope they have is through this paralegalism, that they are able to be empowered to defend themselves in court, that yes, they should understand the court process. They should understand also the intricacies, you know, of handling legal processes, so that as they go to court, they are hanging on to some hope, and they know that they've researched, they have done their very best, they understand their cases, they understand the implications, and that if they understand that what they did was wrong, that in itself is also important, because then it makes them know that they also have to pay back this retribution, you know. So it's very important for women serving life sentences, because it will help them navigate, you know, that court system. They will understand what has happened in other countries, because they also research and see even the best practices in other countries. And as this happens, they look forward to a time when they will go home. So that hope is very important, because it helps them hang on even when there is no way out. Prisoners are people too. They have human rights, and children accompany their mothers are not numbers. They are people. We need them at that formative age so that when they grow up, we will be able to have a healthy society. It is too much spending life for a child in prison. Please help us hand over these children back to society. We've done our bit with their mothers. Please help us so by resettling them when they finish their sentences, and by taking care of their children when they reach 4 years of age or even before. Being a mother is a calling. If you find yourself at the wrong side of the law, don't give up. There's still hope. But please avoid getting yourselves in situations that will make you serve a sentence behind bars. Women, we have a divine calling. Please, before we do anything, let's think about the children that we take care of. Let's not serve sentences with children with us in prison. Thank you.
On Wings, the topic is rights and opportunities of female inmates in a maximum security prison in Mombasa. You just heard Kenya's Senior Deputy Commissioner of Prisons, Florence Omundi. Again, here's Dr. Annette Mbogo, Director of Kituo Cha Sharia Legal Advice Center, answering a question from our producer, Diana Wanyonyi.
You touched something about a plea program.
Yes.
Kindly, can you elaborate what it is?
Okay. So we as Kituo Cha Sharia, we did receive funding under the PLEAD program last year to do our prison work in Mombasa. And the PLEAD program was basically an EU program that supports legal aid and delivery of legal aid services. And the PLEAD program supports both government and civil society organizations through UN agencies. So our program in the Shimo La Tewa prison for the past 3 years was supported under that fund, but it came to an end in December. However, as the ambassador was saying, the EU has renewed that commitment and has given more funds to continue this kind of work, mainly for access to justice for communities, and they are supporting government and also still supporting some civil society groups. Mm-hmm. So one of the successes and achievements of the program has been that our community paralegals have, prison paralegals in prison, have initiated cases in Kenyan courts that have shifted or have promoted the rights of those who are incarcerated in different areas, to a point that some of the decisions have been landmark decisions worldwide. One such case is the prisoner's right to vote in elections. So after the 2010 constitution, the 2010 constitution did not make any distinction as to who has a right to vote, unlike the previous constitution. So Kituo got instructions. It was actually in a graduation ceremony at the Shimo La Tewa Men's Prison, and we got instructions from the inmates to present this case before court. So initially, the case was filed incrementally. First, we began with the prisoner's right to participate in the constitutional referendum. And if you recall that at that time, we were voting either yes or no to a new constitution as the draft. And in that sphere, after we went to court, the court allowed them to participate in the referendum. And after that, in 2013, we said, why not file another case that now extends this right to vote also in the general elections? So we filed another case, again with instructions from our prison paralegals. And in 2013, the court said that prisoners should vote also in the elections. So what happened is that elections were allowed for prisoners, but only with respect to the presidential elections. So last year, during the election year that we had, the inmates, now without any intervention from Kituo, they filed their own case challenging the fact that the IEBC had only allowed them to elect the position of president, and they now wanted to elect all the six positions. And they went to court. Unfortunately, the case went on a bit late, and it was only after all the preparations for the elections had been done, that the court now indicated that yes, they should actually have a right to participate from MCA going upwards.
All six.
Yes, members. Yes. And so the instructions from the court to IEBC is that come the next elections,
that prisoners should vote on all six positions. So you're seeing that that case was initiated by the prison paralegal program. We supported them to file the first and second, but in the third, they went at it on their own. The other case, there's a case that was filed again by one of our prison paralegals in Kamiti. It was the Muruatetu case. This Muruatetu case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And basically, it was talking about the death penalty. With respect to murder cases. So the Supreme Court in that case said that the death penalty with respect to murder cases was not proper within the current constitutional dispensation, and also said because anyway, death penalty should not be a mandatory sentence, so that if someone is found guilty of murder, should not just go straight and sentence them to death. So by virtue of that decision of the Supreme Court, many inmates were released because their sentences were either reviewed downwards because they had stayed for long, and the High Court would look at from one case scenario to the other. But later the Supreme Court gave a written directive saying that this Muruatetu decision should not apply to all convicts who have been sentenced to death. It should only apply to those who have been sentenced to death by virtue of a charge of murder. So there were some who maybe had been charged with robbery, violence, sexual offenses, and they were still facing that. So what the prison paralegals have done recently is to go back to court and say, well, the scenario that occurs in someone who has been charged with robbery with violence is basically the same. So can the court also extend the interpretation of the death penalty under the Muruatetu case in respect to murder charges also to robbery with violence charges and sexual offenses charges, so that other inmates who are caught up in the same should benefit. And the reason for this, so we are not saying that then people who are convicted of robbery, violence, and sexual offenders should be released from prison. So the reason why we are supporting this is because Kenya has not ever executed the death penalty sentence from the year 1982. Yeah, so from 1982. So what happens is that these inmates who are sentenced to death, they remain in prison for the rest of their lives, not knowing if ever it will happen. And that is really torturous for anyone. Because you don't know, maybe if a new regime comes, they might now want to execute the death penalty. And we're saying that if the correctional facility is supposed to rehabilitate, so if you are to rehabilitate, why would you impose a sentence where you're not giving that person an opportunity to rehabilitate? And so that particular case looks at the human rights violation or impact that comes with someone being sentenced to death and that sentence never being executed. And even if it were executed, we're saying that any penalty should be a penalty to rehabilitate but not to terminate or kill someone. And so those are the kind of punishment that courts would prefer to impose.
That was Dr. Annette Mbogo, Executive Director of Kituo cha Sheria Legal Advice Center, speaking with Wings contributor Diana Wanyonyi in Mombasa, Kenya. Not long after this interview was recorded, President Ruto commuted all death sentences to life in prison. That included 92 women. Wings thanks Diana Wanyonyi and all our reporters and supporters. They include your local community radio stations, plus community radio networks in the U.S., Australia, and Canada. Community radios offer volunteer training and involvement. We encourage you to join and support a station near you. Special thanks to WERU-FM, to Suzette Cullen, and to Genevieve Vaughn, theorist of the maternal gift economy, whose works and events can